This is CliffCentral.com.
Please note that the views expressed and the advice provided in this show are for general advice and entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated should be treated as a substitute for your own independent legal advice based on your own specific facts and objectives. Therefore, the presenter and CliffCentral.com accept no liability of any nature whatsoever, either expressed or implied.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg on CliffCentral.com.
I'm Gary Hertzberg, and this is The Laws of Life on CliffCentral.com. Alongside me today, as usual, Lionel Makokotlela. Welcome, Lionel.
Dumela, Gary, and dumela to our listeners and our guest today. And Palesa, dumela to you too.
Palesa's our controller. Welcome to you, Palesa. And Sanbonani to everyone. Yeah. Cool. Palesa?
Hi.
We got you to talk, Palesa.
Finally.
Finally.
Thank you.
Thank you to Palesa. She's controlling everything for us in studio today. Cool. Today we have a two-part show. First up, we're going to be talking to a man called Paul McNally. He's an award-winning writer, media developer, and producer of radio documentaries. Right now, he's all over the news for having written a book that everyone, including myself, is talking about. It's called The Street. And it exposes the world of cops, bribes, and drug dealers. It's quite a frightening book. You've got to read it. It's just a must read. We're going to be talking to Paul about the book, and he's going to be explaining what he went through in order to bring this to us, the South African public. Paul is also the founding director of the Citizen Justice Network, which we'll also talk about. Later in the show, as per our second segment, we're going to be talking to attorney Nuno Palmeira of McLaren's Attorneys in Johannesburg. And it's all about grandparents, because this Sunday, I think it's the 2nd October, yes, which is coming up, is Grandparents' Day. And there's a lot that grandparents and grandchildren want to know about. So Nuno's going to talk to us about the rights and obligations of grandparents. And often grandparents are isolated, unfortunately, from their grandchildren after a messy divorce involving their children. So we're going to speak to Nuno about what their rights are of contact, and whether they can also be forced to pay maintenance for a grandchild if a parent can't pay or refuses to pay. Quite a frightening proposition.
Very, indeed. Yeah. But I guess it's just one of those duties that you have to undertake as a grandparent.
But, okay, well, we'll see. We'll talk to Nuno in detail. Our Twitter handle is Lionel.
At Hertzlaw. And you'll do the spelling.
H-E-R-T-Z-L-A-W. And our Facebook page, The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg. Have a look at it. And if you like it, please.
Thank you. We would appreciate all the support.
Okay, let's talk to Paul McNally. Paul, you've won some awards that, I mean, I just have to bring it to the attention of our listeners. You've won Best Radio Journalism at Discovery Health Journalism Awards 2015. You're the winner. I mean, it goes on forever. You're the winner of the Global and Innovative Competition by Making All Voices Count for Citizen Journalism Program Involving Community Radio. You've won Best Radio Documentary at the MTN Radio Awards 2015. Your science show won Best News and Actuality Program and Best Presenter at the MTN Radio Awards 2015. You won Best News and Actuality Producer at MTN Radio Awards 2014. I was also there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I won Best Daytime Radio Show.
I know.
Yeah, it was a stunning, stunning night that, yeah. You've won Weber Wenzel's Legal Journalist of the Year. It goes on and on and on. Which is the favorite of all these, if you can call one a favorite?
Oh, man. Well, I wouldn't like to choose. I mean, the CNN Award was in 2009, and that's where I met Maggie Eales, and she was a senior vice president at CNN, and I actually dedicated the book The Street to her. She died tragically last year, very young. And she taught me a lot. Like, I moved to London for a few years and met and got to know her a lot better. And she taught me a lot about good journalism and how to tell a good story. Not so much the practicalities of it, but just the sort of intimacy between a journalist and their audience, and how that is really what you're trying to do. You're sort of taking people on a journey where you're both involved and you're both affected, and you should both come out the other side kind of feeling different about the place where you live.
Yeah.
And she was very strong about those sort of values in journalism. And it really reignited my passion for it, I think. And then I came back to Joburg and then subsequently have written this book.
You say something very, very powerful. You say she managed to remove the ego and arrogance from journalism. I so like that. What do you mean by it?
Well, I kind of feel that, you know, you, like I say, like you're, as a journalist, you're really just talking to your audience, you know? And I think often in a journalism space, you can feel that you're just talking to other journalists. Mm. You know, it can kind of feel, especially in an award context, it can kind of feel that you are jostling for something and approval from other people in the media space. When really, if you take that away, you're really looking for a way to change maybe the mind or their opinion or just influence people that are reading or listening or watching your work.
You came back to Johannesburg a few years ago from the UK, I believe.
From the UK, yeah.
Are you originally Irish? I say I can kind of hear some Irish accent.
Or no, from North England. I grew up in Cape Town, but my parents and I was born in North England.
Okay. You joined the Wits Justice Project?
Yeah.
That's a great little organization, isn't it?
Yeah, they're
fantastic.
Amazing.
They do amazing work. Carolyn Raffaele and everyone else.
Yeah, Carolyn was actually at the launch for this book in Melville, along with Anton Harbour.
Yeah.
Yeah, for such a small team, they do incredible work with prisoners' rights, wrongful arrests, huge amounts of influence.
The project was actually started by Anton Harbour, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I think that it's, yeah. Yeah. Which is based on something in the USA, I think.
Very the similar. Innocence Project,
right.
Yeah.
I know I've done one story or one or two stories with Carolyn where she's helped many people that have been in dire circumstances within prisons and wrongly convicted and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Excellent work.
She had a case last year where, yeah, she really took it. She was on it for years and years. And it was a case where no one would believe him, this inmate. And it got to a point where he was even, he was at his wit's end, basically. And it was through her perseverance that she was able to get him out of jail.
Let's talk about your book, Paul. It's exposing a world of cops, bribes and drug dealers. It's called The Street. It's set on Dekkers Road.
Yeah.
Which is west of Johannesburg.
Yeah.
Why that area? What made you get involved? How did this whole thing start? What's it about?
Well, it started as a project, as a brief from Wits Justice Project to look into Sophiatown Police Station. Mm-hmm. So it was as simple and as broad as that. It was just to sort of go into Sophiatown Police Station and see what you could find. And initially, I wasn't sort of experienced with these kind of topics, you know, like cops and bribes. The idea of investigating violence and torture and all these things were all very new to me. And initially, I was terrified, right, to go into these areas and to go into the police station. I actually spent the first few weeks just walking up and down outside the police station, still just sort of afraid to go in.
Mm.
But eventually, I did go in and I met a police officer there who features strongly in the book, Carber, who was frantic about what was happening in the police. He was so upset with the corruption and what he had seen. He was sort of babbling all sorts of things. And we made friends and I won his trust. And then he took me to On Dekkers, where he introduced me to the main character in the book, Raymond, who has a shop on Dekkers. And he sits there most days and nights and takes down all the details of these bribes. So if you can imagine that there's you're sitting in a shop where with a mirror tinted window, you're looking out on Dekkers, this sort of desolate sort of industrial kind of road in West Joburg. And right beside the shop, there's a security gate where drug dealers are popping out every few minutes to sell drugs to drug users, to their clients. But then for about every 10 sales they make, a drug dealer will pop out to give a bribe. So a cop car will be right there out in the road idling, and a drug dealer will come up to the cop car and lean into the car and drop some money into the cop car. And then that's when Raymond would write that down, write the cop car's details down, the time, where the station it was from, and just he was collecting this huge amount of information. And that's when I met him, and we would sit in his shop and watch that, and he would tell me about these procedures.
Did you witness it yourself?
All the time. It was just so, I mean, it wasn't that, say, I tell you about this and it feels like maybe it was kind of undercover and, you know, kind of out of sight. The fact that it was so open, such an open secret, so much in everyone's awareness from, you know, there's little kids walking home from school right by where this is going on. And I think that's really what made me realize that we need to expose this. We need to bring this out into the open, and hopefully in a way that also encompasses everyone's involvement in this, from shop owners to the police to the neighborhood watches to, and hopefully that's what this book does. It sort of brings together, and I'd like to say maybe brings some sympathy for the police as well. I don't want it to be entire, like, it's not a bashing of the police force. In some ways it is also hopefully eliciting some kind of sympathy for the struggles they have to go through as well.
There are a few characters in this book that are very much part of the main thrust of it. There's Raymond, as you mentioned. There's Carber, who's he's a brigadier, or what was his name?
He's a lieutenant colonel.
Lieutenant colonel. There's also a, what do you call them, the private, the lady?
A police reservist.
Yeah, reservist. She's very much part of this book, isn't she?
Yeah.
What's her story about?
Well, she, I met her, Wendy, quite late into the research of this book. And completely became encapsulated by her story, and really thought it was important to include that, because at that point, a lot of the book was about, you know, cops trying to do the right thing, other cops who were clearly very corrupt, and then a shop owner who was struggling with all this morality. And it felt that the reservist, Wendy, she's a woman in her 50s. She's got a sort of a huge shock of blonde hair, and she's been a police reservist for almost 20 years. And she seemed to occupy a different part of South Africa's culture, in that someone who wants to do the right thing has kind of committed themselves to a mostly volunteer position to work in a police station. But then she also was doing the work, by and large, of a police officer. So even though she's a reservist and sort of signed up in that way and getting paid very, very little, she was, because there's so such meager resources in the police station, then she's doing everything from patrolling, you know, walking around with an M5 rifle, which could barely fit her. And I thought that was important to show, like, not only that someone is trying to do the right thing in her own way, but also that when you have so few resources, these things take hold, really. I mean, the interesting thing about Wendy is that she started when back in the mid-90s, her husband was a police officer. That's how she got introduced to the police. She sort of prides herself on her family having that history. And over time, basically, her husband got involved with arresting drug dealers. And around 94, he arrested probably what was one of the most earliest kind of prominent drug lords, Nigerian drug lords in Joburg. He arrested him, and then he would walk around with the docket of the case on him at all times. And he would come up to Wendy, his wife, and say, "Look, I've arrested this drug dealer. It's very dangerous, but I'm keeping the docket on me all the time because I'm worried that it's going to get stolen." So he used to carry it in a briefcase from work to home, back to work, back to home. And he said that he'd actually been offered R1 million to make the docket disappear, which he'd refused. Yeah. And then days later, he was shot outside of his house. Oh. And their son at the time was 6. And he was actually at home and ran out and saw the father die in the driveway. And then Wendy went through a number of sort of life soul searching quests, and then became a reservist sort of in her husband's memory. Mm. And sort of works with that memory and that kind of guidance.
Paul, you talk of police targets. In other words, they have to make a minimum number of arrests in order to meet that target. Just explain that in more detail, because it's quite a frightening piece of whatever the directive it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, explain that.
Yeah, it's a fascinating part of the book, really, is that you go into something like this, seeing bribes, and you instinctively feel that everything is governed by greed and kind of a corruption and a sort of evil. Mm. And as you start to get deeper into this research, you realize the parts of that exist, but also there is this target system within the police. And I was actually doing a talk at the criminology department at UCT yesterday, and they're very strongly against this as well, is the fact that police officers have a target for a number of arrests, and also say a number of like there's an example in the book where they have a target to collect a number of knives. So, you know, word will go out that a police officer has to confiscate a certain number of knives off the street within a certain period. So say it's like 10 knives in a month. But then over social media and WhatsApp, people will send this message out saying, look, the police have a target for knives. You're going to lose your knife.
Yeah.
And we're not talking...
Carry a gun, not a knife.
Yeah, well, there's this thing of like, you can, you know, you're going to lose your knife if it's on you because there's this target out for it.
Yeah.
So then they stop taking knives with them. They've become very aware of that. The trouble is then the police officer gets left with this target that now he can't fulfill because no one's taking knives out. And there's an example in the book where a community police forum member explains to me that he's actually seen sets of knives that have clearly been bought from ShopRite and Checkers have been checked in as part of that have been confiscated. So poor police officers are then stuck with having to meet these targets and they have to go and buy cheap steak knives from a mall and check those in. And you start to realize that people are being treated like children. You know, like they have targets for the number of
drug arrests they have to make.
Yeah. And the thing is that what's an interesting lack of distinction is the difference between a target for the number of drug users. So say someone that's just bought a little bit of drugs and now that you can arrest them and a drug dealer.
Mm.
So if you don't make that distinction, and if it's a drug offense, if it's a drug arrest, then you can see why the police are motivated to just arrest the drug users. They're not motivated to arrest the drug dealers. If anything, a drug den that's producing drug users all the time because they go in, buy some drugs, now they can be arrested, that's actually creating a kind of well that can just always keep giving to the police in terms of for them to meet their targets. And I think that you're introducing these target systems, but they're also not sophisticated enough. So they actually make people act in certain ways that are just not in any way helping crime prevention at all.
The police are very much part of the drug trade, according to you. Am I right from what I read?
Yeah.
We can't quite understand. It is so obvious when you read the book how these drug trades are taking place right in front of your eyes, and yet nothing is happening. Why does it still continue? People are taking drugs. The drug industry is flourishing, and the police are flourishing, some of them, because they're taking the bribes and they're part of the system.
Yeah,
is that what this is about?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would say that. I mean, I spoke a lot with the Institute for Security Studies around this book, and there is a sense that there isn't any accountability within the police, and that is what has allowed a lot of this to take place. There isn't really strong management in any sense on a top level. Mm. And that's kind of filters down to a station level as well. And I think when you have that lack of accountability and you also put people in these horrible living situations as well, then you're not giving the police a great number of reasons not to follow this corrupt path. I think that's the interesting part. Like with Carber, the lieutenant colonel is in the book. I spent a lot of time with him and hung out with him and went to his home, and he actually lives in the police barracks in Johannesburg Central. And his living condition is not, his room where he lives is not much bigger than a double bed. So it's a small room. He has a shared bathroom with everyone else on the floor. And if you go in the bathroom, it's broken tiles. It's just chaos in there, and the windows are sealed shut, so you can't open them. But he's kind of a meticulous man. He wants to have a clean room, so he's bleached the room. So the room just, it just hammers you with the smell of bleach. And he has an affection for animals, so he's adopted a number of cats who live in this room, and he feeds them raw steak on his pillow. So you can imagine this police officer who's trying his best. He's the one who's not taking bribes, and he's coming home to this room, not much bigger than a double bed, with these cats and the smell of bleach. And I was absolutely appalled and shocked that someone who's high up, I mean, this guy is not starting out. He's high up in the police, and this is all he can afford. This is what he's come to.
The end of the book really is the very Raymond who was the whistleblower right up front. In the end, I don't want to give the end away, but I'm not so sure that he pursued what he was intending to pursue, and that was to actually have the whole area cleaned up, to get rid of the drug dealers, to get rid of the foreign nationals that are selling the drugs, to get rid of the corrupt cops. I don't know if that really happened in the end, or is it going to happen?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, I don't want to give away the ending, but at the same time, hopefully that the book is really about sort of survival. And it's about a number of characters who, when you meet them, they have good intentions, you know, and I think they want to try and stop, say, corruption that's happening right out in front as much as they can. I mean, the interesting thing about Raymond is he was actually brought to his premises under the promise. He promised his landlord that he would get rid of the drug dealers outside his shop for cheaper rent. So he actually made that deal, and it was true. He did stop them right outside his shop, but the thing is that they moved 6 feet to the left of his shop and 6 feet to the right of his shop. So they're still very much out there, and you can still very much see them from the shop, but he kept his word in the fact they weren't directly outside.
Yeah.
And it was interesting that he'd come to that spot with that mandate. Like, he was the man who would get rid of the dealers, you know, and over the course of time, he realized that that wasn't enough, that you would have to then pursue getting rid of the corrupt cops as well, or instead of. And I think through the course of the book, he struggles with that. And he struggles with the idea of exposing himself to the police as someone who's going to speak out. You know, a big part of it is that he then wrestles with the idea that if you expose yourself to the police as someone who's against the police, then maybe your security, when you need them, like when you have a break-in or something like that, then they won't be there for you.
Yeah.
And I think, but the people who may be there for you are the drug dealers who are outside your shop. They might offer you security in a different way. And I think that's the fascinating sort of balancing act that someone like that is trying to do. Someone that is so outspoken about this and sets this goal of getting rid of corruption, then there's knock-on effects to that.
Paul, you do mention in the book that the drug industry in that very area is worth fortunes.
Yeah.
Those are figures that were revealed to you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, thousands and thousands of rands
that people are making. The foreign nationals are selling the stuff.
Yeah.
Is it all in the hands of foreign nationals?
Well, no. I mean, the thing is the part outside where the book is set, it's very much a foreign national drug syndicate.
Yeah.
But I mean, there are parts of the set, like West Joburg, where it's not run by, you know, foreign nationals. I don't want to, you know, put it all on them. It is that interesting. But, you know, that also almost becomes a reputation in that area of, like, yes, if you are a foreign national, therefore you must be a drug dealer. And that's something I think in South Africa and Joburg, you know, foreign nationals complain about a lot, rightfully so.
Your life was in danger, had to be in danger many times. From both sides, from the dealers, from the police, who you were reporting on, they knew what you were writing about. They know today that you've written about them taking money, bribes, to withdraw cases, to lose dockets. They know that you've exposed all this. Are you nervous?
No, I'm not nervous. I mean, the interesting part is that I think from the drug dealer's side, they always knew I was a journalist and they were always very happy to speak. And the interesting part about that is that they were happy to speak to me because they wanted the corrupt police gone, at least the top guys. So they had a strange philosophy in that they believed they were selling a product, drugs that would never not be needed. And they also had they really were under no impression that the corruption would ever vanish. But what they were hoping for is that cops that had been around a long time and had been collecting bribes for a long time. And as you can imagine, the bribes go up and up and up, you know, over time.
Is a bribe? How much is a bribe?
Well, it starts, you know, about 50 rand. Right. That's what you're looking at. 50, you know, if there's a few people in the car, it might go up to 200 rand. Mm. So we're talking tiny amounts of money. You know, it's like, that's the thing. You don't want to make an enemy of a cop if you're a drug dealer. But basically, so you never want to say no. So if they come up for their bribe, you don't want to go, no, you're not going to get it.
So the drug dealers sell the drugs, the pushers buy it, and the police take their cut. And that's the system.
Yeah. Well, they're not taking it. Yeah. I mean, it's more like the idea that they're not taking a direct cut of a sale. Yeah. They're actually just whenever they feel that they want a little bit of money, bread money, they call it. Mm. Whenever they want that, they can go up to this spot and a number of others.
You want to buy your kid a toy, you just drive up and there
it is. Yeah, or just get some lunch. I mean, let's face it, we're talking 50 rand. So it's not a huge amount of money. Mm. But there's this sense of like, oh, I just need a little bit of money. I can stop there. I can get a little bit of cash. And I'll never be refused that. But the drug dealers have a good sense of that they don't want to make enemies of these police, but they know that they don't actually have to give huge amounts of cash. So that's what they have calculated on. I mean, when you think about the expenses of a drug trade, the police are just something in their ledger. You know, the thing that the drug dealers are trying to get rid of and why they would speak to me is that they want to get rid of the more confident cops, the ones that are basically there is a procedure where the drug dealers were being held ransom. Mm. So they were being basically it was a pretend arrest. So the police would pretend to arrest a drug dealer. And instead of arresting him, they would actually hold him ransom and, you know, get him on the phone, tell him that he has to phone his boss, the big drug lord, and say, look, we're going to negotiate a price now for what you're worth. And that would be in the amounts of 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 rand. And that's where the police get their real amount of money, right? So they hold it. That's not 50 rand, that's 5,000 rand. And I think that's what the drug dealers were trying to get rid of, because then you get rid of a few of those guys and then a few more amateur police come up from the bottom and then they only want 50 rand, you know.
Paul, we're running out of time. Okay. We've given our listeners a taste. It's a book that is an absolute must read. If you live anywhere in South Africa, you've got to read this book. Anton Harbour says, it's an important piece of journalism that gives rare insight into Joburg's rotten underbelly and the criminals, cops, and citizens who coexist there. Beautifully said. Matata Tsedu says, from drug lords to gangsters to captured police who take bribes daily, McNally's book chronicles in a very fresh way the breakdown that has happened in Sophiatown. Please read this book. I really urge you to. You just need to as a South African. One more thing before I let you go. Quickly, I know you're very involved in the Citizen Justice Network.
Yeah.
In 45 seconds, what could you tell us about it?
Well, we train paralegals in rural areas to be radio journalists. Mm. So basically, we have people, paralegals that are in communities who people come to them with their problems, and we train them to turn those problems and cases into good legal journalism stories that then they can put on their local community radio stations. And then that will help people get awareness around issues that they don't hear
things
about.
Like protection orders that people need know about how to get one.
Yeah.
So you bring people real life stories into your studio.
Yeah.
Well, I've done a lot of that and I like what you're doing. Terrific.
Great.
It's the way people learn.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to hear your story, and from your story I'll learn how to handle it.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely.
Protection orders, citizenship. There was a 16-year-old that had a case, I don't know if you know it offhand, one of the cases you brought to the fore.
Yeah.
Excellent journalism.
Yeah,
terrific.
Stateless, and also done by people that are in those communities. So it's not a sense that we are, you know, parachuting in and telling people what to do. We're allowing them to dictate what the issues that they feel are important and create those stories themselves and distribute them themselves. We just give them as much guidance and help and training that they need.
This is the voice of winning journalist Paul McNally with a string of awards. Before I let you go, anyone you want to thank besides your wife and your kids?
I'd love to thank the people at Justice Project, Carolyn and Ruth and Anton and Nusheen, who was there. They really helped start this book when it was in an article form many years ago. Yeah, and it wouldn't exist without them.
Benji, if you wouldn't mind tweeting a picture of Paul McNally's The Street, put it up if you can. Many thanks to you, Paul. And
thank you.
We'll follow your progress. I think this will be a bestseller.
Thank you very much.
Good.
Thanks.
Talk to you again.
Yeah.
Cheers.
This is CliffCentral.com.